this is Hindsight on ABC Radio National, and I'm Lorena Allam. Today, a tale which lays bare the pitfalls and potholes encountered while trying to understand the past. It's about the controversy surrounding one of Australia's earliest European buildings, Experiment Farm Cottage at Parramatta. Last year, the historian Sue Rosen published the book Australia's Oldest House, where she claims that as the owner and custodian of the property, the National Trust mismanaged and misinterpreted its importance. For Sue Rosen, Experiment Farm Cottage is one of the most historically significant buildings in the country, one which reveals new ideas about colonial New South Wales. In today's program, Johan Gabrielsen wades into the debate over the origins of Experiment Farm Cottage. Along the way, he uncovers the human story behind the house, the life of its original owner and creator, the Irish surgeon John Harris. Here's The Oldest House, A New Beginning.
We're halfway, or more than halfway, through our training. Well, unfortunately, I don't know much of the history, so I'm hoping to learn more today.
A group of volunteers are being trained to guide visitors around Experiment Farm Cottage in Parramatta. There is some confusion about when the house was built.
1800 and some, early 1800s, I think.
1812.
So when exactly was the first house built in Australia? If Experiment Farm Cottage in Parramatta had been built in 1795, that would make it by far the oldest intact house in this country. Its original owner, John Harris, would have been a visionary pioneer of Australian architecture, a decade ahead of his time, and the house would be one of Australia's most important landmarks. But the National Trust, which owns the house, firmly believes that the house was built in 1835. And if that's the case, that will make it just another example of early architecture in Australia. The Trust relies mainly on a letter which it says proves that the house was built around 1835. But an historian called Sue Rosen now says that letter is not valid and that the Trust got it wrong. So where does the truth lie?
Well, the official story is it was built between 1835 and 1837.
Right. So a bit later.
Well, it depends on which
historian,
I believe. But the National Trust's historians believe that was the time which it was built.
I think part of it is the desire for an historical trophy. So to be able to say this is the oldest house in Australia, that has obviously a strong attraction.
Ian Stevenson used to work for the National Trust. He's a firm believer that the house was built in the early 19th century.
The neighbouring house, Elizabeth Farm, which was built in 1794 by John MacArthur, that's traditionally been accepted as the oldest house. So there's a certain lustre, I suppose, in being able to assemble a claim for Experiment Farm Cottage. And I think in history, we are often drawn to what attracts us without necessarily being systematic about the evidence. I would quite like to see Experiment Farm proven to be the oldest house. It would rewrite the architectural history of the colony and what was achievable in those very formative years.
I suppose I was, when I was in my teens, I think, I first started to be interested and I started to collect newspaper cuttings or any articles about him, about Experiment Farm, and I've just gradually over the years built up more and more of a collection of some original things.
John Harris is a direct descendant of the John Harris who purchased Experiment Farm Cottage in 1793. The current John Harris lives in one of the most exclusive neighbourhoods in Sydney. The whole table in front of us is stacked with letters, newspaper clippings, books, maps, paintings, and photographs of Experiment Farm Cottage.
Those letters that I've shown you came to me one day when I was, I think, about 20. An old lady who was a distant cousin, would have been second or third cousin, who was in her 80s, asked me to come to her house at Strathfield and see her, and I didn't know her before. And she produced an envelope full of these lovely letters that had come down through her aunt, and she wanted to ensure that they continued in the family, and she, having no children herself, wanted to pass them on, and to a John Harris especially, that pleased her very much. So 45, 6 years later, I've looked after them, and I'm very grateful to her for giving them to me.
Harris was born in Northern Ireland. He was the oldest of six kids, and his father died when he was a child. The family had a lease on a 68-acre farm.
This is the historian Sue Rosen. She works from an office in northern Sydney. She has for many years tried to uncover the mystery of when Experiment Farm Cottage was built. She believes that John Harris was a visionary and a man with just the right temperament and experience to have built the Experiment Farm Cottage in 1795.
Harris joined the Navy probably in the mid-1770s. That would have been prompted, but his mother was a widow. He was the oldest of this large family, and that was a way that he could get his medical training. 1783, he was on the HMS Defence, which went out to India, and was engaged in the Battle of Cuddalore against the French. In that battle, the English had something like 300-odd casualties and more than 100 dead. And it was in those sort of circumstances that Harris developed his skills as a surgeon, which he then brought onto the colony. So 10 years in India, you know, second mate's not very high up the scale.
John Harris's career as a surgeon in India was at a standstill. But Harris had found a book written by Captain Watkin Tench, describing a new colony in Australia.
Our adventures had, however, the pleasure of discovering and traversing an extensive tract of ground, which they had reason to believe from the observations.
To the dismay of his family, John Harris decided not to settle back in Ireland.
Which a happy soil and a genial climate.
Inspired by Tench's book about a new exciting continent, Harris signed up as a ship surgeon on the Second Fleet to Australia. A decision that turned his life in a direction he could never imagine. Harris would become one of the richest men in the new colony.
He ended up in a stoush with the ship's captain prior to leaving the UK, because the Second Fleet, they were slave traders who were contracted by the British government to do the Second Fleet. And the ship's captain was utterly outraged that Harris tried to tell him what to do in regard to how the convicts were to be treated, because he was trying to intervene and secure proper conditions for them. And unfortunately, the Second Fleet had a massive casualty rate because they were paid on how many they embarked, but not how many they delivered.
Half past nine, I was woken by a sergeant. He said the convict women were rioting. He was afraid they would kill each other. I asked for one of them to be put in hand irons. Then the captain arrived and hollered several vulgar phrases. I told him my name was Mr. Harris, upon which he said Mr. Harris might be damned. Who gave me the authority to command his ship? I reasoned with him on his improper mode of conduct, telling him he knew better how to act properly.
The nature of the Ulster Presbyterian is to be, you could say, a bit dogmatic. The most extreme version of, we've seen them in the troubles in Northern Ireland in the last 3 or 4 decades, not happy with seeing wrongs, wanting to ensure that things are done their own way. John Harris did have a streak like that. He would have probably been quick to react in temper, There are a number of examples where he seems to have had a bit of a hot temper. They tend to believe that the way that they see things and the way that they want things done is the right way.
Initially, when he arrived here, because of all the starvation and what, they were all pretty down. And the fact that when they first came, there was no prospect of them ever acquiring land. And he wrote to a mentor in the UK, just warning people, don't come out here. And the thing was, what was particularly galling for him, is that he had done his research. He had visited the First Fleet in the UK before it left and checked out their preparations and talked to people. He had read Philip's account of the colony, and he had also read Tench's account of the colony.
Of our situation on this barren, inhospitable territory of New South Wales, which God forbid that ever another pupil of yours should be so unfortunate as to embark on any expedition to such a place, let the prospects be ever so alluring, and which I am sorry to find not so promising as I flattered myself previous to embarkation. Tench had been too sparing in his opinion of this place. A true statement of the land that adventurers might not emigrate to a place where they can never hope for gain, but penury and want. Let their industrious endeavours be ever so great.
Clue number one, in search of a building date.
I'm standing on the veranda at Experiment Farm Cottage. A group of school children are having a picnic under a nearby tree. The tree is believed to mark the spot where the first owner of Experiment Farm, the convict James Roos, had his house. The head guide explains to the volunteers how Roos cultivated the land and that the farm was an experiment by Governor Philip to find out if the colony could produce enough food to feed itself.
What he did firstly was clear the land and burn it and dig it in. And he did this several times before he planted any corn. So that when he finally planted his corn, the land was much more fertile than when he had started. So he was able to go back to Philip within 15 months and declare himself self-sufficient. In return for this, Philip granted him the first land grant by a European to a European in Australia of 30 acres. He continued farming here until 1793. 1793, he sold out to John Harris.
Harris himself, when he arrived here, he was fairly bleak about the prospects of getting on in New South Wales. And yet by the time he died in 1838, he was one of the wealthiest men in the colony. So it's a really great symbol about Australia as a country where people can achieve things.
Soon after arriving in Australia, Harris got a lucky break. The chief surgeon in the colony left for Canada, and Harris was swiftly promoted to head surgeon of the newly established New South Wales Corps, based in Parramatta. Harris was not impressed with the accommodation.
Only three people in the colony are properly lodged: the governor, the judge, and the commissary, all in a small and ill-judged scale. The officers' rooms in the barracks are badly planned. One room, the allotment for each, and so small as barely to be able to contain all things.
Harris bought John Roos's land near the army barracks in Parramatta, known as Experiment Farm today. He soon discovered that in the new colony of New South Wales, those willing to open up the surrounding countryside were rewarded with parcels of land.
Harris was a member of the parties that went out in what really were explorations. They, after all, were covering land quite close to the new settlement of Sydney, which hadn't been gone through before by Europeans. You had to have those early, more less significant exploration tours, which themselves were fraught with some danger. And Harris got himself into all of them. Fairly stocky man, fairly prominent chest, and rather sort of square-headed.
I'm shown one of the few images of Harris that exists. He's short and stocky with a rectangular face. He looks stubborn. There's an uncanny resemblance between the two John Harrises.
You can see a similar shape of body.
He was granted land for his participation in various expeditions. Harris managed to produce a substantial crop that he sold back to the government. On the 28th of September 1800, Philip King became the new governor of New South Wales, and Harris's life changed forever.
I think that King was the making of him. By 1800, Harris was 38 years old. I think that King knew him from earlier days, because King had also been in the colony earlier. King saw what Harris was achieving. I don't believe King would have picked up Harris in the way that he did and appointed him to these various positions if Harris hadn't developed that property. So the idea that Harris lived in James Roos's convict hut is ludicrous, because he might have lived there before he got the grant and when he just first started developing it in those really terrible, impoverished days. But once he had got his grant, he would have been just compelled in terms of his own personal energy and drive to build something substantial.
It was quite common that the early settlers working for the Crown were paid in building materials. This is a list of what John Harris received from the Crown in 1794.
300 goats, 5 horses, 32,000 bricks, 132 bushels of lime, 1 roof, 20 feet by 16 feet, another roof, 40 feet by 18 feet.
Clue number 2. In search of building materials.
In 1984, the New South Wales National Trust commissioned the architect David Sheedy to write a report on Experiment Farm Cottage. His conclusion conflicted with the position of the Trust that the house was built in 1835. According to Sheedy, Harris procured enough building materials to have built the current Experiment Farm Cottage, and that all evidence showed that the house was built around 1795.
The earliest exciting piece of evidence was finding that reference to the building materials and then checking with David Sheedy and saying, could this build Experiment Farm? And I gave him the quantities and he came back, yes. And interestingly, in the whole debate, nobody is querying that quantity of material, or not that I've heard, couldn't account for Experiment Farm Cottage.
In David Sheedy's report to the National Trust in the late 1980s, there are analyses by Dr. George Gibbons of the then New South Wales Institute of Technology of mortar from Experiment Farm Cottage. The sample is almost certainly late 18th or early 19th century. It is more likely to be 1798 than post-1814.
The mortars generally became more substantial, more sophisticated, more lime in them as the 19th century progressed. But none of these things individually is infallible.
James Broadbent is one of the most senior heritage curators in the country and is a consultant for the National Trust. He maintains that the evidence clearly shows Experiment Farm Cottage was built in 1835.
I think the building history of what houses, what huts on this site is very complex. I don't think that one perhaps will ever be able to work it out. We do know that there were people living here since the grant to Roos, but too much has been made of various written sources and written references, I think, in this argument. To me, it's rather like conducting an autopsy and not looking at the body. Historians do believe in primary documents and primary evidence. Well, the primary evidence when you're looking at architecture is the building itself.
Mm-hmm.
John Harris's career flourished and he spent more and more time in Sydney. Governor King gave him land and material to construct Altamont House that stood near today's ABC building in Sydney. But what do we know about the use of Experiment Farm? Those who argue for a later building date say that Harris neglected Experiment Farm in favor of the splendor of Altamont House, which was then one of the most elegant residences in the colony. It's also claimed that his increasing duties in Sydney kept him away from Experiment Farm Cottage. But there are some records that dispute this argument.
Clue number three, in search of the residence of Master Harris.
Sydney Gazette, 1804. Surgeon John Harris will be in his Sydney house on Tuesday and his Parramatta house on Saturday to inoculate children.
In 1821, Harris invited Captain John Piper, who Harris called Jock, to his house in Parramatta.
Experiment Farm Cottage, May 24th, 1821. My dear friend Jock, Mr. N has promised me another case of this cognac brandy for my own dry drinking. If you will permit him, as it is so good and not too strong for my use, and of superior flavour, you will oblige me of giving him the order. That is, if you wish a drop for yourself when your great honour visit me at my large house here.
This is a copy of the letter from Surgeon John Harris to Captain John Piper.
Experiment Farm, 1821.
It's mysterious.
Clue number four, in search of a veranda, part one.
One of the main arguments against an earlier building date is that veranda design was not part of Australian architecture until at least 1815. But two incidents on record in John Harris's own life contest this belief. In a 1799 court case involving the theft of several pigs, the judge advocate Atkins, who Harris had accused of being a swindler, had this to say.
I often dined and associated with Dr. Harris and had been invited by him to join his St. Patrick's Day celebrations. I have enjoyed the social conversation on the veranda and was not then reputed a swindler.
Clue number five, in search of a veranda, part two.
Patterson accused Harris of falsely repeating to Governor King a conversation they'd had on Patterson's veranda.
Harris behaves with ungentlemanlike conduct. I have never been a talebearer of conversations for the sake of creating mischief, with no other purpose than to give trouble to others, which in this instance has been completely effected.
Harris was a shrewd operator in many ways. The whole New South Wales coroner offices, that there was just politics and rivalry. It was just fraught. It was only when Governor King turned up that Harris really started to gain wealth and positions and status.
And that's because they became very good friends. So.
They had a very good relationship. So too had King and his deputy governor, Colonel Patterson. Harris manipulated the breaking up of that long-standing 10 or 12-year relationship between Patterson and King, where their families would dine and all that. He informed King at one point that officers had met on Patterson's veranda, in Patterson's veranda, and had been saying nasty things about King.
Bungello.
Harris spent over Bungello. 7 years in India. He was stationed in Bengal, where roofs and verandas were perfectly suited to the Indian climate, and also ideal, some would suggest, for the hot Australian summer. But curator Ian Stevenson says there are no records to support the theory of a veranda being built in the colony as early as the 1790s.
These arguments of context saying, well, Harris was in India, he would have seen bungalows there, therefore he must have built a bungalow in Australia. He must have built this very sophisticated bungalow in the mid-1790s. There were plenty of other officers who'd been in India as well. This knowledge was not exclusive to Harris. Why didn't they build similar places? If the present cottage had been built in 1795, it would have been completely extraordinary, exponentially much better than any other houses. Why does nobody comment on the house?
Just because we were unaware that there were verandas prior to 1800, or we haven't seen a painting of one, doesn't mean that they don't exist. Intellectually, that argument has no weight. James Broadbent's been cited that the veranda was never able to be used prior to 1815 as a place of social or interface between people, because there was only one entrance to a veranda from the house, and that would be through the main doors. But we've got the evidence of Richard Atkins, who was suing Harris for defamation, where he says,
I've enjoyed the social conversation on the veranda.
And he's talking, not once met somebody furtively on a veranda, he's talking about that the norm. I too have enjoyed the conversation of the veranda. Richard Atkins was speaking in 1799, and he was talking about the preceding period. And then in 1802, when there was a breakdown in relations between Governor King and Colonel Patterson, it was because officers were meeting on Patterson's veranda and gossiping and drinking and talking about him and saying insulting things.
Walter Guthall is charged with my cattle. You know how to act with him, a slippery fellow. You have the power to dismiss anyone who is not useful. There are too many cows for butter. Reduce them as you see fit for my interest. Discharge anyone who is not doing justice.
This letter was written 1 year before John Harris died. By then he was one of the richest men in the colony. He was married but had no children. Towards the end of his life, he lived on the farm Shane's Park outside Sydney. His vast land holdings, including Experiment Farm Cottage and Ultima House, were given to relatives who had come over from Ireland. The only stipulation was that every firstborn son had to be given the name John Harris.
The tradition was maintained, and I'm sure really out of respect for him, there was that sort of feeling that we've been perpetuating his legacy by continuing to name a male member of his family by his name.
Experiment Farm stayed in the Harris family until 1921, when it was put on the market. In 1961, the National Trust of New South Wales bought it. The trust restored the house and in 1963 had an official handing over ceremony.
And I was invited to hand the key to the governor on the front veranda, and he would then open the door and declare open the new refurbished house. There's a photo in the local Parramatta newspaper of all the people sitting on the front veranda, both sides of the door, and then at the appropriate time I was asked to stand up and step forward and hand the key over.
Did you make a speech? What did you do?
I just said, Your Excellency, I have the honour to hand you the key so that you'll be able to open it. Thank you.
Clue number 6, the deciding letter.
Look, it was regarded as a 1798 house right through until 1977. That was a long-standing tradition. When the National Trust bought it in 1961, it was reported to members of the Trust that the house had been bought and was believed to have been constructed about 1798. There was never any argument about it. And through the 60s, that continued to be the case. It wasn't until 1977 that a researcher for the Trust found a letter from Mrs. MacArthur to her son Edward in England, which she wrote quite late in her life. She's still living at Elizabeth Farm, next door to Experiment Farm. In 1839, she wrote, speaking of some friends who were living in a new cottage on Dr. Harris's estate.
His little wife and three little ones, who are our near neighbours, and have occupied a new cottage on the estate of the late Dr. Harris, will follow as soon as they can get a house in Sydney.
The Trust concluded that the new house mentioned in Elizabeth MacArthur's letter was Experiment Farm Cottage. But not everyone at the Trust was happy about the conclusion.
Well, my involvement came about through a commission from Caroline Simpson.
Caroline Simpson from the Women's Committee of the National Trust was one of the first to question the veracity of the evidence purported to be present in Elizabeth MacArthur's letter.
She was very concerned about the lack of involvement of historians by the National Trust in their projects and was really annoyed about the treatment of Experiment Farm Cottage and the fact that David Sheedy's report, which dated the cottage to the 1790s, had not been endorsed, had been put on ice without really any substantiation of the reason for that. And so she commissioned me to do research on it.
His little wife and three little ones, who are our near neighbours, and have occupied a new cottage on the estate of the late Dr. Harris.
In your opinion, what's wrong with his letter?
Okay, well, what I decided to do was to investigate Campbell. And what I found out was that Campbell, in fact, yes, he was the police magistrate in Parramatta at that time, and he had purchased land from Samuel Marsden and had built a house across the river, directly opposite from Experiment Farm Cottage. She wrote her letter on the 6th of March, 1839, and in a sketch dated the 20th of March, 1839, Comrade Martin's painted the house.
She talks about a completely different house.
Yes.
She doesn't talk about Experiment Farm at all.
No. There is no evidence anywhere ever that Campbell lived in Experiment Farm Cottage. And why didn't anybody investigate Campbell thoroughly? That sketch of the house that I just showed you, I found that in the Mitchell Library card catalogue under Parramatta Residences. It's been in there for 50 years.
I think that it is a lot of fuss about very little. I think that it is a house that was 50 years ago mistakenly thought to be earlier. Now, that argument cannot be sustained except by Miss Rosen, who seems to keep on wanting to stir the pot over it.
There was one group of people, not exactly new to the Trust, but they clearly wanted, I think, to put their mark on the buildings.
Janet Hay was a close friend of Caroline Simpson and a fellow member of the Trust Women's Committee.
It's a bit like a decorator, really, who says, I'm being employed here to do a job, so I better put my best foot forward and get something that I will be remembered for.
Even if it's not true?
Well, they may have felt it was true. Well, my feeling was that it was simply bizarre and silly to try and interpret the house to that very late date, when we all know that Surgeon Harris definitely lived and worked in Parramatta in the 1816, 1825, because there are records to show that he did.
For the last 30 years, the interpretation of Experiment Farm Cottage has reflected the Trust's firm belief in the 1835 construction date, right down to the furniture. Apart from the letter from Harris to Captain Piper, there's not a hint of speculation on display that the house might belong to an earlier period in Australian history. James Broadbent from the National Trust.
Yes, I've been involved with the house probably since the late 1970s, and that connection off and on has continued to the present. There is almost no information I know about the use of verandas, really, pre-1830 in Australia. With the hindsight of 50 years more analysis of Australian colonial houses, there just seems an overwhelming amount of evidence, physical evidence, that points to a construction of the second decade of the 19th century, if not the third. Its furnishings have been introduced, brought in, to try to explain the house, explain a lifestyle in the house, to really to interpret the house. What we see in the past changes and should change. If I was a university lecturer and gave the same lecture this week as I gave 30 or 50 years ago, you'd think me a pretty poor lecturer. It is the same with the interpretation of a house like this. It has to be kept relevant.
But the question remains, what is interpretation and what is history? And what other historical landmarks in Australia have followed the fate of Experiment Farm Cottage, that of an ambiguous biography?
Well, I really would like to be persuaded very strongly of the argument for the 1830s. If he is entitled to the credit for having brought the style of Indian bungalow to Australia for the first time, then I don't want to see that entitlement denied to him unless there's a very strong case for the alternative.
You know, you just realise how, you know, difficult life must have been, not only for the people who lived here, but for their servants. Imagine what their living conditions were like.
I'm standing with the three volunteer guides in the basement of Experiment Farm Cottage in Parramatta. Through the cracks in the floor, shadows of people can be seen.
but if people come and ask you, how old is this house, are you clear?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's a conservative estimate that they've put on it. It could be earlier, it could, but I don't think it's any later.
Yeah. Mm. What do you think?
Well, I sort of seems a little bit confusing because of all the different dates that we see around, particularly the letter up there.
Well, I agree, it's very confusing, but it's obviously not known as a fact.
Yeah.
So they're estimating, they're doing their best estimate, I'd guess.
But the reality is we have this beautiful house, which is unique and will always be unique.
The Oldest House, A New Beginning was produced by Johan Gabrielsen, and the sound engineer was Stephen Tilley. Melissa Stafford read from the journals and accounts of Irish surgeon John Harris. And thanks to the National Trust of Australia. This is Hindsight on ABC Radio National. Well, the surgeon and original owner of Experiment Farm Cottage, John Harris, who featured in today's program, must have had dealings with the subject of our next feature, the Governor of New South Wales, Lachlan Macquarie. Macquarie was considered a reformer who encouraged exploration for land expansion, which is likely how it was that John Harris accompanied John Oxley's expedition across the Blue Mountains in 1819. Last year marked the bicentenary of Lachlan Macquarie's governorship of Sydney. As part of the anniversary, a group of visual artists came together to present their perceptions of Governor Macquarie's contribution to the state. Today we take a look at the work of one of the artists, Tim Miller, who became fascinated with the western expansion of Sydney during Macquarie's tenure, and how it might have been experienced by the Indigenous people of that country. Ros Blewett visited Tim in the regional New South Wales town of Bathurst.
In a series of evocative landscapes, artist Tim Miller has decided to paint scenes west of the Blue Mountains at the precise moment of the first English gaze. It was, of course, during Macquarie's time that the Blue Mountains were officially crossed. Tim's first painting, entitled Campfires Across Gingin, Binjang, Bondadgeri, Gobolian, Ganjarang and Bugan country depicts steep, densely vegetated gorges in muted colours, creating a haze that envelops the area and suggests an endless unknown. The Aboriginal presence is subtle, with faint streams of smoke rising from behind hills and through valleys. Tim has painted this landscape as it may have been before the arrival of wheat and sheep, farms and towns.
Well, I'm looking across a fairly rugged piece of country out across the Abercrombie River, and where the river is, I have plumes of smoke coming up where small groups may be living in the early morning. There's a bit of rain just starting to come across on the left. I used Oxley's journals, Macquarie's journals, Evans' notebooks to try and recreate how it may have been.
From several of the hills over which our route led us, we had the most extensive and beautiful prospects. From 30 to 40 miles around, from the north to the south, the country was broken in irregular low hills, thinly studded with small timber and covered with grass. The whole landscape within the compass of our view was clear and open, resembling diversified pleasure grounds. The animation of the whole scenery was greatly enhanced by the smoke of native fires in every quarter.
From John Oxley's journal of 1817, which inspired Tim to paint many of his images.
It's been west of the mountains that I've been looking at. It's not just Bathurst, it's sort of basically out to Wellington, out where Oxley went, out to Hay, along the Lachlan River and back again. I've had my mind in the past, even when I'm driving around, consciously not noticing what's there. I'm looking at the shape of the land and looking around in the ground, trying to find where people may have been.
The Macquarie era was the great era of early exploration. It was when some of the most substantial discoveries and breakthroughs were made.
Historian David Roberts from the University of New England has closely studied the history of this region west of the mountains.
I think people had been trying to get across the Blue Mountains for many years, and perhaps some actually had. But it was the famous and much publicised crossing of the mountains by Wentworth and company in 1813 that sort of really literally or supposedly opened the west to the colonists, even though they themselves didn't actually make it all the way across the mountains. But in the wake of that expedition, a number of well-known explorers were sent out west to see what basically lay beyond the mountain. What they were looking for was largely open pastoral land with lots of grass and lots of water. And so what they found around Bathurst and beyond seemed very, very promising.
This is also where the Tablelands Way road now goes. Incidentally, one of the things that I've been finding out is that a lot of our roads are actually pathways that have been there for thousands and thousands of years. I've tried to perceive these pathways, how they may have been.
There's no doubt that the first explorations and the carving of the first routes across the Blue Mountains definitely followed Aboriginal pathways. In fact, I'd be quite sure that Wentworth and Blaxland Lawson, the famous three explorers, actually had Aboriginal guides with them.
In Reflection 1819, A View Across Burraburra, Gundungurra and Wiradjuri Pathway, Tim has painted a mesmerising late afternoon scene. Dense bush and undulating mountains as far as the eye can see, seemingly impenetrable. Yet faint plumes of smoke rise from the valley floors. The foreground is slightly cleared, where one sees the beginning of a rough track.
This is the pathway that Oxley and Big followed from Bathurst to meet Macquarie at Lake Bathurst in 1820. Evans described the view across Bathurst as being very green or verdant, would make good grazing land. it had been made like that, I would think, by people over thousands of years and who'd had farmed it for thousands of years and who had their own similar farm spaces that people have today. But we haven't been taught to see it that way anyway. We've been told people were nomadic, but people had their own specific spaces to live.
Certainly the arrival of Europeans in that area, particularly in the 1820s when settlement starts to really become denser and intensified, has a devastating impact on Aboriginal people. And then particularly when we move into the late 19th and early 20th century, there's a lot of dispersing of Aboriginal people, a lot of movement into other areas. I mean, Oxley was under very specific instructions, not just to get a handle on the nature of the topography and the minerals and the flora, etc. He was actually under specific instructions to make some accurate and informed scientific observations of Aboriginal people. But he did see signs of their presence everywhere. He saw smoke in the distance, he saw campsites that had been abandoned, he saw the distinctive carved trees that the Wiradjuri made.
And I've tried to look at the landscape of how it may have been when Evans came across and where people may have been living. I know where all the streams are on the land.
So you've sketched what you feel it looked like 200 years ago.
Like it may have looked 200 years ago. Bathurst is in here. We go out to Sydney, out through Gap in the Hills here.
Is that the Macquarie River there?
That's the Macquarie River at Wellington. This is a place where we stayed, camped down in behind this hill. And this is all cleared land now. And there are farm houses and whatever down through here. And it was a very special place. And all around here, there's just thousands and tens of thousands of artefacts.
Certainly when Oxley, when he got to Wellington, was a very significant site for him because that's where he encountered the Macquarie River. I think it was known and is known to have been a very, very important Aboriginal place. Shortly after, when colonists began to arrive there, they actually found not only a lot of Aboriginal people and a lot of Aboriginal campsites, but they actually found a very large collection of carved trees. So I think it might have been a very important religious site. And a lot of those trees remained in existence until late in the 19th century.
Obviously, it was a meeting place, and I have found writings from 1829, which is after Macquarie, though, describing this area very, very, very clearly. And it has taken me about 8 or 9 years really to find exactly where it was and how it is, because it's not there obviously at all anymore.
Tim Miller's great skill is using form, colour and the sublime to evoke a perception of how the land and its inhabitants might have appeared to early 19th century explorers. Tim and his son camped in the areas he intended to paint. Following Oxley and Evans' compass readings, which proved to be exact.
And I went and stayed out on this hill, and Oxley made a diary entry around this area.
We had a very extensive view to the north and east, a beautiful range of hills.
Stretching north and south, bounded at a distance of about 8 miles, with a fine, extensive valley before us. The animation of the whole scene was greatly enhanced by the smoke from native fires.
By the smoke of native fires. The actual shapes of the land wouldn't have changed a lot. The vegetation has changed to some degree, but the same vegetation that was there is still there, even though diminished.
I think the smoke is very effective. I think just the plumes of smoke are more effective than if you'd drawn people there.
I feel that, yeah.
Why do you feel it?
I put the plumes of smoke there because I haven't seen the people there, but I've seen the signs of the people being there, and it wasn't very long ago, and there's a lot of stories that have not been told.
I think there's always need to reflect on these sorts of aspects of our history. But certainly in looking at the bicentenary of Macquarie and what happened in the Macquarie era, the consideration of the opening of the West is very, very important, provided we look at it from a multifaceted point of view. The old hubris about the great expansion of the colony, it needs to be countered by understanding that there was essentially people already there who suffered very seriously from the arrival of Europeans. So as long as we look at it from many different directions and understand it as a complex story, then we can also begin to appreciate its greater importance.
In people's minds, people have their house in such and such a suburb or such and such a something, wherever, or in a, on a farm or whatever. But I'm sure a lot of people sit down and think, well, what other family was living here 500 years ago? Who was here? How was life then?
Ros Bluett, speaking last year with artist Tim Miller and historian David Roberts from the University of New England. Tim was part of an exhibition to mark the bicentenary of the tenure of Governor Lachlan Macquarie in New South Wales. Next week on Hindsight, we're marking an anniversary much closer to our own times. 30 years ago, 10 Republican prisoners in the H Block section of the Mays Prison outside Belfast undertook a hunger strike to the death. Their aim was to achieve special category status for those imprisoned under Northern Ireland's extensive anti-terrorist and emergency laws. The hunger strikers were led by Bobby Sands, the officer commanding the provisional IRA prisoners. What led those 10 young men to strike to the death?
There can be no question of political status for someone who is serving a sentence for crime.
Britain has spent from 1976 until now trying to criminalise the prisoners. And six men have died in the most eloquent and starkest of statements, saying that it's impossible to determine, given our legal system, if we did anything. It's impossible for anybody to be reasonably sure that Bobby Sands was fairly convicted, any of the men inside or the women. What they are simply saying is, were not for the existence of the political struggle, we would never be in a position that we would have broken any law. We are prisoners not only of the prison, but of the political problems. And they want recognition of that.
Crime is crime is crime. It is not political, it is crime. And there can be no question of granting political status. I just hope that anyone who is on hunger strike for his own sake will think fit to come off hunger strike, but that is a matter for him.
Her attitude was that they were criminals, convicted terrorists, and this open contempt she had for them and for the political program that they stood for created huge revulsion in Ireland. And memorably, when the third hunger striker, Raymond McCreesh, died, his brother, who was a priest, gave the eulogy in the village of Camlagh and memorably said, "My brother is not a criminal."
The prisoners have made every attempt. They don't want to die. But what they're doing is they're fighting with the last thing they've got left. And from 76 until 1980, when the hunger strike was embarked on first in October, men tried every weapon. They were systematically humiliated and degraded to the point where, with their naked bodies in isolation, not even allowed to leave the cells to use toilets, they had nothing left to fight with. And the choice that they then took, and they do have a choice, the choice is, in the fight to live with dignity, to be prepared to die for it, or to live with no dignity, which is death.
That's "My Brother Is Not a Criminal," next week on Hindsight.